Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 126, I'm joined by Dr. Irina Sway of the University of California, Los Angeles. We discuss her work on the Zika virus as well as macular development and retinopathy of prematurity. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now privileged to be joined by Dr. Irina Sway. Dr. Sway is assistant professor of ophthalmology in the Department of Retina at the University of California, Los Angeles. Dr. Sway, thanks for waking up early with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Jay.
So you're a new guest to the program. All new guests get the same question, which is, how did you decide to become an ophthalmologist and then a retina specialist?
Interesting question. So I am a second-generation Chinese-American, which I recently realized second-generation means different things to different people. So I mean, my parents were immigrants. They came here for graduate school. And so I was very close to my Chinese-speaking grandparents growing up since my parents were working. And I brought my grandparents to their doctor's visits all the time to translate for them. So that is how I got interested in medicine to start with. And then in medical school at University of Pennsylvania, I started off interested in geriatrics. And then during my clinical rotation, I realized I was more surgical. So I was looking for a surgical subspecialty, fell into ophthalmology, I would say a large part because of Stuart Fine. He was the chair of UPenn Shea at the time. He did such an amazing job instilling ophthalmology to all medical students, whether we were interested in ophthalmology to start with or not. He made it relevant for the person going into primary care or ER or pediatrics. And so that is how I got hooked to ophthalmology. And just to fast forward a little bit, retina is another thing that I didn't plan on. And I was a resident at Columbia from 2005 to 2008. That was a very exciting time at Columbia under the leadership of Stanley Chang. And besides his presence and example, it was an amazing time for retina. So I would say, because I've been asked this question before, I've thought about it. In that time period, when I was a resident, there were three major changes that caused retina to really grow, and to be a resident during that time was amazing. So one is OCT. It had just started to be widely used. I remember in clinic, we would look at time domain OCT, which is all speckled, couldn't tell what was what, and everyone was just amazed at having an OCT. Period. So OCT is one of them. It was also the start of the anti-VEGF era. So, you know, Lucentis came out in 2006. We had started using Avastin in 2005. I remember using it on NVG patients that were horrible when they came in with, and they come back the next day with better pressure and bleeding better. So anti-VEGF is the second thing. Third one is it was the time that small gauge surgery started to come out and be popular. And I remember one of my mentors, Hermann Schubert, was a little bit skeptical of it at first, and then he quickly caught on to it as well. And I think just seeing people's reactions to small gauge surgery, both guarded and excitable, and then what a difference it made in surgical time and outcome, as a resident was very exciting. So that is what brought me to retina. And then just to conclude this little share about my personal journey, it's all kind of come full circle now because my grandparents and translating for them is kind of what made me interested in medicine. I now, since 2013, practice in Arcadia, which is a multi-generational, predominantly Chinese-speaking population of patients. And it's something I always wanted to be able to do, which is to serve a Chinese population. And so when I go there, it brings me so much joy and job satisfaction to interact with Chinese families that remind me of growing up and some of the struggles that my family had. So yes, I'm very happy to have fallen into the position, both personally and professionally, where I am now.
So one of the things is, you know, one of my colleagues, former co-fellow is Ali Khan, who's one of your colleagues now at UCLA. And he told me you've done a lot of work actually looking at Zika virus. So tell us a little bit about the Zika virus and ophthalmology and then the work you've done at UCLA.
Sure. So, well, thanks to Ali for noticing and for recognizing that, because I feel very grateful to have been a part of this Zika virus research team that is a multi-specialty organization between UCLA and an institute in Rio, Brazil called IFF, Institute Ferdinand Figueira. And I guess I'll talk about how I got involved a little bit first, and then I'll give you a little bit of background on Zika and where we are now. And one thing that I'm very grateful of the timing of the fact they're asking me to do it now is because I feel like the general media and people have kind of not had as much interest in Zika, understandably, because the rates of new cases have fallen a lot over the past year or two. But I really think this issue still matters because, one, like dengue and other ARBO viruses, it may cycle. I hope not. But one, it may be cycling every few years. And two, there's a whole population affected with Zika, and we're still following these children who are now 3 or 4 years old in Rio. And so I do want to give a lot of attention and credit to the families that deal with the Zika babies and the big team of doctors that still continue to treat them as they grow up. And so thank you for asking me to talk about this topic to start with. So, you know, the Brazilian Zika epidemic took place, the government called a crisis between April 2015 and November 2016 is when the state of emergency ended. And basically, at that time, what happened was there is an ID specialist, Karen Nielsen, at UCLA. She's from Rio. She was born and raised there, went to medical school there, and then she came to UCLA for fellowship and has been on faculty ever since. She had a medical school contact who put her in touch with Patricia Brazil, an infectious disease specialist in Rio, that had an existing study looking at pregnant women with symptomatic dengue for, I think, over a decade. She had been studying pregnant women that had a fever rash for years, drawing their blood and urine and following their babies very carefully. And so when Zika was first realized in northeast Brazil, Rio is in southeast Brazil, it gave the IFF team in Rio some time to modify their pregnancy IRB and collect prospective specimens on women with symptomatic Zika virus. And that is how the cohort started. And so there's a collection of over 350 pregnant women that have been referred to ISF through the study or other avenues of the study. And then the infectious disease specialist at UCLA connected with the infectious disease specialist in Rio. And then they put together a multi-specialty team. So they were looking for an ophthalmologist, an OB specialist, pathologist, radiologist, pediatrician, neurologist, and that is how we got started. So we applied for funding. The NIH granted us an R21. I remember writing it in May of 2015, and then we took our first trip in December of 2015. We flew down as a team, and since then, I've been there every 3 to 4 months. So I'm going again, my last trip is in May, I'm going again next week. Every 3 months or so, we go down and we meet with a counterpart there at IFF. My counterpart, there's a lead ophthalmologist, Andrea Zinn. And so they are the ones, Andrea and her team, which consists of a huge multi-specialty group, including three ophthalmologists, three and counting, They see the Zika babies in a program every three months. The babies come back and they spend the whole day there and see all different doctors and collect data. And we've discussed areas of interest moving forward. And so that is kind of the logistics of how our research collaboration works. We provide funding, just basically collaboration and design of the study, data collection and writing, and friendship, I have to say. These people have become my friends, and it's really a wonderful experience, and I'm honored to be a part of it.
So, you know, one of the things that other things you've worked on is ROP.
Yeah.
And ROP is very complicated disease. It's a very stressful disease to take care of, I think, but the people who take care of it, because it is a serious problem, and we do have more options than we had before in terms of anti-VEGF in addition to traditional laser or cryo. Let's talk a little bit about macular development in ROP. You have a couple of publications you looked at using OCTA imaging and then looking kind of the inner retinal layers in OCT. Tell us a little bit about what you found when you did these studies and what the implications may be.
So the ROP work I've done started a few years ago when there's a set of twins who are about 10 that came into my office, and we were just testing out the OptiView OCTA machine. It's 2016, and we were asking for volunteer patients who had time to go down and get a scan. And so what I noticed was that the set of twins born preterm, around 25 weeks or so, they had a very small FAZ, which correlated with an immature retinal architecture in the fovea, which has been well described by Cynthia Toth. And so that just led me to think, oh, that makes sense that the FAZ would correspond to having a thicker retina in the center. And I wanted to see if that was true for most ROP patients, or what risk factors there would be for having that, especially in childhood. So Cynthia did a lot of work in the NICU, but to my knowledge at that time, I didn't realize that it would be persistent and present upon a school-age child. So that's how it started. We collected, I believe, 20 or so OCTAs on preterm children and compared them with non-preterm kids, all in the age of 6 to 12 range, and found that there was a correlation, a very strong relationship between how young a person was born and whether they got treated with laser. So that was, I think, innovative, interesting, just because OCTA was so new. So, you know, anything using OCTA was interesting and novel. And of course, FA is difficult to get on kids. So the fact that it was a quick test, did not require fluorescein dye, was made it very easy to do. And then since then, as a follow-up study, we've gathered more kids. And these children are also seen by the pediatric ophthalmology team. So they have that's corrected vision. They get refracted and a very careful vision check in PEDS clinic. And basically, the follow-up study showed that the amount of immature retinal development did correlate to vision. So that was something I was not expecting, that patients who had a thick retina in the center, their vision was usually not able to reach 20/20. It wasn't terrible. It was maybe like, I think, an average of 20/30 or so, as opposed to 20/20. With a FAZ that was fully formed, it was 20/20. Without, it was more like 20/30 or so. So that was huge, that there is a relationship to vision. And so since then, we're just continuing our work, both in clinic on the school-age children and with a portable handheld OCT in the NICU to gather more data on this and what it means. And then, interestingly, just because it, I think it's really pushing the boundaries of ROP care, Wei Qi from Taiwan published a study in AJO in May, which showed not OCTA, but OCT findings in school-aged kids between the ages of, I believe his was 3 to 12, something in that range. And he showed that with anti-VEGF, it did affect the foveal structure. So he had a group of 3 kids either treated with laser, anti-VEGF, or not treated in the NICU. And when they grew up, the anti-VEGF kids were able to develop a foveal pit, and as an extension, putting in the work for my study, presumably better vision than an infant treated with laser who maintained the immature fovea. So it may be, I mean, it's a little bit early to say, but it may be that anti-VEGF could be more definitively shown or replicated to show that it could affect foveal development and hence vision, as well as we know now, the peripheral changes of ROP.
Do you take care of patients with ROP regularly? I mean, what is your preferred practice pattern for these patients? And this is something that's, again, very variable, patient to patient, but also provider to provider.
Yeah.
When do you prefer to do anti-VEGF? When do you use laser? When do you use both?
So my treatment paradigm has evolved over the years. What I'm doing now, I think it's pretty standard and conservative. And speaking of the other, I think this is probably what many people do, which is when there is an infant with type 1 ROP or aggressive posterior ROP that needs treatment, I, in zone 1 or posterior zone 2, will offer anti-VEGF to the parent. And it's a lengthy discussion about the risks and benefits and the unknown risks systemically. And I would say most parents choose to have anti-VEGF over laser. There is one in my memory recently who the baby was so sick and they chose to have laser instead. And that's fine. But I think most in that situation would do anti-VEGF. And part of it is how I explain the risks and benefits. I would say I'm an advocate of anti-VEGF in that case. Occasionally now, I think babies are born so early, it's a different type of preterm eye. Sometimes they will actually have zone 3 ROP that has some features of type 1, meaning there are some plus or stage 3. And so in zone 3, which is less likely to reach type 1, but it can happen, I would recommend laser just because I think it's a little bit of area. And I usually, with the anti-VEGF-treated eyes, will go back, and after 52 weeks of age, I will do an FA and then laser the persistently non-perfused retina. And that is just kind of for peace of mind, because studies have shown that the retina may never fully vascularize. It probably doesn't after anti-VEGF, and so to kind of decrease the burden a follow-up. It is a lot of babies to keep track of. And of course, as they get older, beyond 52 weeks till like 3 or so, it's very difficult to examine the retina. So that's my general protocol, that I don't necessarily tell the patients it's anti-VEGF or laser, but it's anti-VEGF with delayed laser versus laser at the start as a treatment option. And then the other caveat with that is here in LA, there are a lot of families that come from far away and may not have the resources for follow-up. So with the anti-VEGF treated eyes, I do see them weekly until the EUA with FA and laser. So if follow-up is a problem, and I tell the parents, when I'm talking to them about anti-VEGF or laser, if they say, you know, we have 6 other kids at home, we live more than 4 hours away, I can't come back every week, then that might be a reason to do laser as a first option rather than anti-VEGF, just because of the burden of follow-up.
You know, my last question, I know you guys have very good fellows at UCLA. You work with the trainees, and I think pediatric surgery, all retinal surgery, is hard to teach somebody. pediatric surgery is a completely different animal. It's almost like retinal surgery on steroids sometimes, depending on what you're trying to do. Mm. I mean, if you were teaching fellows or if there are people out there who are trying to learn to do pediatric surgery, either from a colleague in the community or a mentor, I mean, what are kind of the biggest things you've learned in kids that are different than working in adults from a surgical perspective?
From a surgical perspective, I think the pre-op and post-op evaluation is very important and very different in a child. So I know it might not seem surgical, but I think it is that the decision to do surgery and the decision of when to do a follow-up EUA is so important. So I think we obviously don't want to take children to EUAs very often or too often because of the risk of anesthesia and the stress to the family. But it is important to know when there's something wrong. And I would say part of that is listening to the parents, describing how the child acts or what the child says at home. And part of it is getting to know the child in clinic to see if they are behaving differently than they have on prior visits. Surgically, I would say maybe this is a little bit counter to what I just said, but I would say that it is okay to stage things a bit, to not be too aggressive at times. So in some of the retinal detachments, I will try to buckle it first, and then see, and then if needed, I can go back and do a PPV and go from there. So I think it's all very different and highly variable. But for me in practice, it's really the preoperative and postoperative decision making, knowing when to put the child under for an EUA, what is worrisome, what isn't, is something I'm still learning and something that I enjoy, and I feel like that takes experience and patience and not something people can just pick up. It's a little bit of the art of medicine applies there with children.
Well, Dr. Sway, thanks so much for waking up early to join us. The time difference is always difficult, but we were able to find a mutual workable time. And again, Ali is one of my good friends, great colleague, has been on this program before. He speaks very highly of you and the work you guys are doing. It sounds super exciting.
Thank you. We really enjoy having him here.
So thank you again for your time and everything you do.
Great. Thank you so much, Jay. Take care.
You have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 126 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Round and Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes, and at the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the Apple Store as well as Google Play. We're on Twitter at RetinaPodcast. You can contact us by clicking on the Contact Us link on our website or emailing us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback about things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Sway for joining me. Drs. Louis Kai, future doctors, Mike Vinicasa and Angela Zhang, thank you for producing this great episode. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.